Hi, welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
I really got out a lot out of today, and I think of this as marketing and promotion. I'm actually walking away with development and growth.
Yeah, I thought this whole experience, the mentoring conversation before we started recording and this conversation after, was extremely helpful.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. If you're in transition with your business and how you're leading, they go together, please call me right away at 1-612-804-8920. Use We Mentor Inc. to reinvent or evolve yourself while you redesign your business so you can take charge of your self-leadership process and overcome internal challenges assertively. Sally Doyle is our sponsor for today, and go ahead and schedule a profit analysis. She founded Absolute Business Solutions, and you can get a profit analysis for only $99. You can take charge of your money life. You can get a second opinion. She's known as a trustworthy bookkeeper, profit strategist, and innovative thinker who loves crunching the numbers for small business owners and entrepreneurs. You can sleep soundly knowing every dollar in your business is 100% accounted for. You're freed up to do the work you're good at and keep leading. So call Sally today at 1-651-208-8151. All right, now on with today's conversation. So meet Geeta Mazumdar. Her website project is named Mystic Maruba, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. So Geeta says, and I quote, "She was made in India on the coconutty west coast along the Arabian Sea. What luck to have been nurtured by a playful father, an orderly mother, and both her grandmothers. In her first few years, she was held for long hours by her beloved body, an elderly Adivasi, which is an indigenous woman, who cared for her while her parents worked. Her first food were her unusual grains cooked in clay. She cried for her when they moved away from that early home. The story is that she refused food, chanting body 108 times before her father lost count. Her paternal grandmother, Maine, prepared bakri, confident that it would break the spell. Hours past bedtime, she placed the spiced bread in front of Geeta. She regarded it silently, looked up and wailed, body! Exasperated, her grandmother said, eat your body's fat chapatis, and snapped off the lights. The next morning, there were no signs of bakri and no more chanting. Why don't you continue on with your story?
Wow, I still think about body, actually, and it brings tears to my eyes. I still
know,
miss
your
her,
eyes
like,
are all
over
welled
50
up.
Years later.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. She was just, she held me all the time, 24 hours a day, it seemed. What would you like me to talk about?
So, you moved to the Goa land?
We
land
moved
land of
to,
seafood?
Yeah, we moved to Goa. We used to live on another side of the country, and my parents were posted there. They were both doctors, and they just couldn't live on this east coast of India. So we moved back to the west because it just felt like familiar ground and familiar customs and familiar food as well.
Yeah.
And we moved to Goa, which is just south of Bombay by about 400 miles.
Okay. So tell us a little bit more about your journey.
We were Gujarati. So ethnically, we're from a little bit further up the Arabian coast than Goa is. And we've always lived along the west coast. my daughter did a 23andMe and found an ancestor also from the same area from 11,500 years ago. So we, when we speak of our ancestry being from that region, we say, oh, over 80 generations. But if you think of 11,500 years ago from doing DNA tests, it's a lot longer. We are indigenous to that strip of land by the Arabian Sea.
Yeah.
And that's why it feels far away from home when you're, you know, in the middle of a continent on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit more about the foods that you were introduced to.
So as a Gujarati, it's like the most vegetarian cuisine in India, you know. The other cuisines have, if you're a coastal person, you eat fish, and the other cuisines eat some form of animal foods. But Gujaratis, their form of animal food, they feel very proud that they eat dairy. And so I grew up in Goa, where it was, you know, a Portuguese colony for almost 500 years.
Mm.
And it is not considered a meal if there isn't something that has eyes that was cooked up and made into a curry. So I just smelled it growing up and didn't eat it. And we had maids and cooks who were going, and they cooked for us, and they wouldn't even eat the food because it was not their custom to eat that kind of food. And so the food was just made without any interest. And I didn't find the food interesting at all. And there's a saying, actually, that, you know, indifferently made food will only satisfy half a man's hunger.
Mm.
And that's true. It's like there was nothing nice about the food. I just would eat because I was forced to eat. But I lived with my maternal grandmother, and she sat with me. She was very patient, and she would tell me stories. And so each bite, I would get a little bit further in the story. And that's how I made it to 18, made it to adulthood, didn't starve to death.
Yeah, so you've always had this strong connection to people and food and traditions and where food, how it's prepared and where it comes from.
Yes, yes. And I would think that that's the average experience in India. It's food preparation is sort of it's the center of things, you know? I mean, it's your day, you're thinking about how it's going to be lovely in the form of all the delicious things that are going to be made and perfuming the house and kitchen.
I think about the smells and warming the house, but I just feel like we're in such a rush all the time that food preparation is like a secondary thing, and it's lost its savoring tastes and its nourishment.
Yeah, that is actually a huge, I would say, cultural disjointed part about this West and East thing. It's the things that make up our lives in where I grew up were the important things. So being with your family, taking time off when a child is born, or to hang out with your grandmother because she's sick, or that sort of thing, is okay. Whereas over here, I think you worship or feel proud of the fact that you sacrificed all these things to go to work. You sacrificed spending 2 hours to make your meals just so that you could work and turn in whatever important thing there was for work. And the things that make up life are still the focus, I think. Perhaps not now that things are changing a little bit. It is becoming it's evolving into a little Western trended place. But people still really gather and eat together at the table, and it's freshly prepared food on a daily basis. Leftovers is not a habit in India. We eat freshly prepared food at every...
Boy, that seems like a luxury right now. Yeah. And the reason that we're talking so much about food is because you prepare food for so many people. We're going to kind of gradually kind of move into that because it's a really, your journey is so unique that I would like to just kind of carve it out very nicely. So at age 22, you left India to pursue film school.
Yes, yes.
How did you come about deciding that?
I got a degree in philosophy from the University of Bombay. And then I took a gap year. I traveled for a little while. And it was the first time I had ever left the country. I'd basically lived next to the Arabian Sea all my life. And at age 21, I graduated from University of Bombay and went on a little backpacking tour in Europe, went to the Western world that you read about in books and saw in the movies. And I just thought, like, wow, this is so different. This part of the world needs to know about that part of the world. And I thought that I'd like to do it via film and photographs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My father had given me his old 1939 Leica when I was 18. And so I spent some time taking photographs with that old camera. And then I took it to Europe with me. And so I thought that was a nice way to show one part of the world about the other part.
Yes. So what made you decide to move to California?
I just applied to a whole bunch of schools. And California is famous in the rest of the world. It was, you know, the world of the 1980s. So it was just New York or California. Anything in between was unknown to me. Minnesota was certainly unknown to me.
Yeah.
Except in a geography lesson in fifth grade.
Mm.
So I applied to schools in California and I applied to schools in New York. And my dad advised me to go to California. And that's where I went to school.
Okay. And Maine subbed.
Oh, when I left,
yeah.
She was the only person who paid attention to the fact that I was going away. It was not a significant event in anybody's life. It wasn't like I was making any big move or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I just packed my own things, two suitcases. I had applied to colleges on my own. My parents didn't even live in the country at the time. And so I had done all this on my own, and I was coming to America to go to film school. And she just wept because for her, I was of marriageable age, and she just felt like, this is the end. What was the point? All the things I taught you, all the things we did. She never had any girls. She had two sons.
Mm.
And I was the first girl that came and lived with her, someone who was like a daughter. I was her granddaughter. And she was this amazing cook. And in fact, there's a story about my dad when he and my mother got married. They actually got married in New York because they did their residency in New York. And my mother made the first meal. And she was looking at my dad all excited. And he said, not bad, not bad, not as good as my mother's. And so she just said, I'm never cooking for you again.
Oh.
So
she never did.
She didn't. She just said that she didn't have time for all that nonsense. And especially if she was not being rewarded by my dad. He did the same with me, actually, whenever I would make the food. He would, too thick, too thin, you know. But I knew what to go for. I wasn't making mediocre food that was being praised. I just knew I had to make it better. And then, you know, after the 20th try, it was just the right texture.
Oh.
But now, as a, you know, a person in her 50s, I realize, because I'm now feeling sophisticated enough to think that I'm at par with that grandmother, I realize that you can't call food that's not just right good, you know? It does need to be the real deal before it can be praised for being good.
Yeah, I see. So there's a certain standard.
Yes.
About cooking that's always present.
Yes.
In all the meals that you make.
And so she was this, I was the only girl that she passed down, you know, this continuous culture of cooking and the stories of all the women that, of the family that she was telling me. She wasn't actually such a big storyteller, but I did get quite a bit from her. And when I was leaving, she just felt that this was it. I mean, she used words like, you're cutting off my legs. And it just felt really sad. She cried like it was a funeral. And she just felt that I wouldn't come back. And she was right, because I married a man from America.
Mm.
And I didn't come back. And she was the only person who thought that might happen.
Oh, okay. Yeah, for you, it was a new adventure.
It was. And I just felt like, oh, I'm just going away for 3 years. Why are you crying like this? 3 years, that's nothing.
Yeah. And here it's, yeah, a permanent move.
Yes.
You got a film degree then from, what school did you attend?
We went to Brooks Institute of Photographic Arts and Sciences.
Okay, and that's
it's
where you met
Santa
Jim?
Barbara. That's where I met Jim.
Okay. And then you guys eventually got married. And tell us a little bit more how you got to Minnesota and what were some of the interests. Your love of food has always been there. And yeah.
Okay, so I have an interesting thing to tell you about that. I grew up Gujarati, therefore vegetarian. And Jim's father, Jim is literally the son of a butcher. So meat is a huge component of his diet.
Yeah.
And so that was our big cross-cultural event, was that we had to find a way that we met in between. So in the beginning, we used to, during the weekdays, we were vegetarian, and weekends he would prepare food on the grill, barbecue, and I would make some side dishes and things like that. And I started eating what in India is called non-vegetarian food.
Okay.
And it took a while. It took a while. That probably was the huge and the thing that, you know, was the noticeable cultural difference. Since that time in 1988 when we got married, I have learned how to make a variety of non-vegetarian cuisines of other parts of India than just my Gujarati food. So that it tastes like all the smells I was smelling when I would go to people's homes and not eat their food because it had meat or fish or chicken in it.
Okay. When did an urgency grow in you to document and pass along the customs and stories from your ancestors? Because that's part of what you've been working on lately.
Yes. I'd say in my 50s, I started really wanting to reconnect. It became meaningful. We were so busy raising our children. And
you've got two?
We've got three.
Three.
My oldest is almost 29, and my youngest is going to be 21. So we were busy raising them, and we were raising them over here, and they often called me an Asian tiger mom and all kinds of names. But really, I did not raise them like an Indian mother. I feel like we were somewhere in between the U.S. and we had little stricter standards. And I don't know why. You should interview them and ask them why they were calling me those names. You know, I tried a little bit with folklore. And about the only place where we regularly visited the Indian culture was through food. And we'd do a few festivals and things like that, but it was difficult, you know, when the rest of society is not celebrating Diwali, which was yesterday. Happy Diwali to you.
Oh, thank you.
You know, we do little symbolic things for the festivals as they were passing. But food was our main way of being connected to India and remembering it. After the last born went off to college, I realized, I don't want this to die. And I started crying and I realized why my grandmother was crying. This is something that we have passed down and preserved for centuries. And I don't want my children to forget how to cook and how to eat that food that is so nourishing, and it connects you to your earliest history, probably to the Arabian Sea itself.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'm going to write this down. I'm going to be the one who, it doesn't stop with me. I'm not going to be the one who lets it die. So I'm going to write all this down. So I'm going to write down the stories. I'm going to write down the cooking methods. And people are spending less and less time in the kitchens, as you just observed.
Yeah.
And with it, there's a loss of knowing how to live well, because I do believe that your health is connected to the whole process of food making, you know, all the little elements that go into making the food that ultimately is in front of you to eat is important. And it's a long process. It's not 15 minutes before you eat that you throw some pre-prepared thing in front of you.
Yeah.
It's you begin digesting when you start thinking about your meal.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you can live really well if you pay attention to how to live, if you live with attention to those details.
Yeah. You developed a business, but you're not in a business that of how we would describe you working, because you call it the project.
Yes.
And we initially met through Jody Stankey, who owns Talent Performance Group, and some friends. We actually got together twice and had your meals that were in stacked up in canisters. There were five canisters of food and chickpea, you know, different things in each. It has a long history in your family, and it actually is connected to the first film that you made in film school.
Yes, it is. So that's a tiffin, the canisters tiffin, that yes. you're speaking of.
Yeah.
And there is a system that's still in place, by the way, the Dabbawala system in Bombay. And it's because of the belief that your home-cooked meal, the meal made with care and with love, is... that's the ingredient. Those are the ingredients that will nourish you.
Yeah.
And so take a look at my film again, if you would like.
Yeah. And I'll put it in the show notes so people can just click on and see the film, because it shows how that each lunch is made at home.
It is.
And it's assembled in the tiffin, which is called the tiffin, which yes. is the lunch.
Yes.
And it's carried a long ways.
Yes.
I mean, it travels through many different places, like anywhere along the way, it could get lost. And they all look the same. So I don't know, you know, they have...
It's an amazing system.
It
and
is.
And it's fascinated people. People now come and... tourists want to go and watch these guys doing the exchange, but they come and pick up the food
mm-hmm.
from your doorstep, take it to the station, and it's like a mini postal system that happens daily, and you get your home-cooked meal at the office.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. And even, you know, some of the wives were writing little notes to put in the lunches. I thought that was just it's a beautiful tradition. And when we ate the meals, I mean, it was so special thinking about you preparing these meals for us. And so it's not a business. You have the orders on your website and you make different foods like each Wednesday or once a month.
It's once a month. I make
Wednesdays.
A different, it's a thali. So a thali is the way that Indians eat on a regular basis. That's how... our food is served. Would you like me to talk about that?
Yes.
So there are several components to making a complete meal. And the thali consists of, I mean, each region has a different kind of thali, but a basic thali would have a rice, a lentil dish, a cooked vegetable dish, a bread, a fermented pickle, some kind of chutney, a little bit of fresh vegetables chopped up and marinated in a little lime or some kind of acidic medium, and occasionally a small bite of sweet, and that's to encompass all the different flavors. And that's a complete meal, and it has to have a minimum of 7 colors. It has 6 flavors, 5 textures. It has a little bit of the 4 elements, which is earth, water, fire, and air. And I can go into detail about that too. And then the 3 different qualities of something that wakes you up, something that calms you down. And then the balance in between. And then you never eat alone. You eat in community, so you have to have 2 eaters. And that's that one unity with all that we are part of.
Mm. So it's a collective place in which all the elements are used, and we connect ourselves with the earth through each other and through the food and all the preparations that it takes to put all that together.
Yes. And so we remember we're part of an ecosystem, that we are taking from, say, the earth and passing on. We're just part of some cycle, and we are connected through this daily ritual, this 2 or 3 times a day daily ritual.
Yeah.
To what we are, really.
Yeah. And I like the focus that you have on women's role in society, and that's part of your cookbook that you're putting together, is the stories that connect with food. So the recipes kind of have a story that goes with them, so you understand a little bit more about what you're eating and how it was prepared.
Well, for instance, I make a dish that's called Kabuli Chana. And Kabul is in Afghanistan. And we got these chickpeas from that region possibly 3,000-4,000 years ago into the Indian cuisine. But we still call it Kabuli Chana. We still remember that it originally came from the region that is now Afghanistan.
Oh.
So the recipes, if you really look at them closely, you get quite a story just from looking at the ingredients and how they changed over time. You can see the passage of time through recipes. And some of them, you know, are through the stories. And there are parts where, you know, I mean, there are some grandmother stories. My maternal grandmother told me that, oh, yes, you know, in very, very ancient times, we were just nomadic pastoral people who were moving with the seasons. And we were originally from like the China region, from the mountains, and then we came to the sea. There's nothing in our recorded history that says that we're from China, you know?
So these stories that women are sharing.
Yes.
You're trying to capture some of those.
I would like to. I mean, whether they're true or not true, because things become folklore when they get passed down for long enough, you know? I mean, each time it's something is lost and also something is gained during translation, a little bit of fiction. So there's a little bit of this misty truth in there.
Yeah, exactly. So through your work in which you're passing on, you're describing kind of the larger philosophy of what motivates you in the work that you're doing. But prior to reaching that, you tried out a lot of different types of things to get things to work for you.
Yes, that's true. I've spent 25 years of my life being a photographer, and it served me well for that part of my life. I don't know whether I outgrew it or I just have a different life now in my 50s. I just am redefining what is important to me, and that just didn't feel important anymore.
Yeah.
This reconnecting to a past that I didn't pay that much attention to while it was being passed down to me.
Mm.
And I feel it's similar with my children right now. It's not as compelling to them, but I want it documented for them, because maybe in their 50s, they'll wake up and say, hey.
Yeah.
I am older than the human being that I'm inhabiting in this body right now, and I want to know my older story.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I'll have it for them, or at least the best version I can come up with. I think everybody tells it differently.
Yeah. So the Mystic Maraba project, before that came about, you had tried, this must have been after your photography or
yes.
something where you
yes.
were trying more of a commercial aspect
yes.
to like running a business.
Correct.
Yes.
So I ran with a partner, St. Pops, which is a popsicle making adventure.
Yes.
And we made from local harvest, we'd make seasonal fruit pops and then sell them at the farmers markets and different events. It was interesting, but as a business, it just became something that just didn't match with my style of doing things. And I am very focused on ingredients and them being eaten and produced during their peak. And you don't want too much transportation because every step that's added alters the food that you put. So the best food is made from the best ingredients. And when we were running a business, it started becoming about something other than the food. It was about branding. It was about pricing. It was just became more of a commercial project that I wasn't feeling like this creative person. I felt like something else.
Yeah, and there was even like with the FDA, the requirements that they had with the Food and Drug Administration.
Yes, we worked with it's the food department. My partner did all the business part of it, but we had to have an inspector come and check out and make us. You have to clean your dishes in a particular way, and you have to work out of a commercial kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a certain flow, and they watch you and make sure that you're up to certain standards. But then you're using, this percentage of bleach and washing your fruits in this way and that way. And just even putting bleach on your hands kills certain microbes and can affect you and your digestion. And just think of it, if you're putting it on the food, you're just affecting all these people's food. And it's not how I do things. And so it didn't really work very well with me to add chemicals into food.
Yeah, and as you're describing this, we're eating out so much more. And so if this is the standard that's required of every restaurant, then that means that we're getting farther and farther away from the foods that nourish us.
Exactly, because they're less living. The more alive the food is, the better it nourishes you. Only about 10% of what you eat is the elements like vitamins and minerals and carbohydrates and things like that. The rest of it is about digestion. It's what you digest that makes it into your body. And so if you kill the things, the enzymes and the microbial activators.
Antibodies.
Yes. Yeah. Then you're not getting any of it. It's just passing right through you without delivering anything to you.
Well, and it explains why we're having more and more gut problems.
Yes.
We're not feeling well a lot of the time.
It's only in the last, 75 years or so that such huge, one would think with all this enriched food and so much food and all these things that we'd have better health.
Mm-hmm.
But there's much more chronic disease and there is less nourishment from all this. And so my form of wanting to eat the ancient foods is that, look at the population of India. We did okay with that old-fashioned way of eating. It's the most densely populated country in the world. So they didn't seem to suffer too badly from the food and the methods that they used. And we still use some methods that are I mean, you can see old cave paintings and carvings using the exact same methods. And there are ancient recipes that I use still.
Well, and the hardest part about kind of putting the cookbook together seems to be the measurement. And your degree of precision would change the recipe based on certain ingredients and how fresh they are and, right, how the taste is blending together. And
it's a more instinctive way of, I mean, some of the recipes, some of them I have because my mother actually was, she was a researcher, so she used to really write down everything. And she wrote down recipes, which I have her book. She wrote them down in the language that they were told to her. So if she got them from a maid and the maid spoke in Marathi, she has the recipe written in Marathi. And unfortunately, I never learned how to read Gujarati, which is my own
native language.
And so some of the recipes are written in Gujarati. And I did have my father help, you know, in 1998, he sat with me and we went through the book and he read all those and I wrote them down in English. So I have that. But they were, you could hear the accent of the person who was speaking because she was just noting it down as the person spoke,
okay,
you know, with her recipes.
Yeah.
But the measurements are cook it until it's done. You know, there's no time over there. You know, it has to be soft. Or put 4 annas worth of coriander into it, and I just go 4 annas. That's not even a currency that we use anymore.
Right.
So what I did come to realize, because my grandmother used to mock me when I tried writing down recipes, is she says, you don't do it that way. You have to smell it, you have to taste it, you have to, you know, feel the texture.
Yeah. All that good
that's
stuff.
How we did it.
Yeah. This is just wonderful. So we'll take some pictures too. We're in St. Paul at your house. And in the kitchen, you're making this new bread. It's whole wheat bread, but it's not a typical bread.
It's a sourdough.
It's a sourdough bread that, it reminds me of my mother. So I come from many generations of women who were everything was homemade. And my mom has won awards for her bread making. She never commercialized it because on a farm, I mean, she was just making, you know, 7 loaves of, you know, I mean, we would eat like almost a loaf a day. Yeah. So she was always making bread and just all those smells. So it just reminded me when we walked in and you showed me the raising of the bread, the dough. It just reminded me of being at home on the farm. Yeah, so the smells stay with you for life. And I think you carrying on the stories of women and really emphasizing the importance of how we connect and share stories over meals. And so if we're having less time preparing meals, I mean, that's part of what I enjoyed about the French African church group that we were part of is all the cooking that we did. I didn't do it, but I was, you know, just there with them, with everyone making it and eating it. And so it was such a way in which we had a better connection with each other.
Yes, it's true. I mean, it's sitting down to eat. Actually, that is one thing that one of my daughters, I remember when she was doing homework during high school, and I used to insist that we eat together. And she said, nobody eats every single day together. We don't have to eat dinner. I'll get it later when I'm done with my whatever she was doing.
Yeah.
And I just felt like, well, that's not living if you don't eat together.
Yeah.
You're not a family if you don't sit down and eat together.
Yeah. So it's figuring out which traditions are, you know, you want to carry forward and the enriching part of how you're living your life, I think, is really wonderful. And I wanted to emphasize that in our conversation. And I'd like to have another conversation with you to go a little bit more in depth about the project that you're working on, the Mystic Maraba project on your website and how people can kind of engage with you. So thank you for being here. Thank you for our conversation and for sharing your history and the traditions and bringing alive the foods that we're making in our own homes. And because it's Thanksgiving time, the smells are coming back to us and that maybe we'll, you know, carry the feeling of Thanksgiving and sharing more meals together. We'll be doing that more frequently in the future. All right. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer, videographer, mon frère, brother from another mother. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you all next week. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become more effective as a business owner? Do you want to reinvent yourself or evolve as you redesign your business? This is a dual innovation process. Are you ready to take charge of who you next become? If the answer is yes, I've been developing and implementing mentoring programs to thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and business owners and their teams since 1992. Totally love it and feel I'm on this planet to involve the leadership in the world from the inside out. Of course, this means seeing myself as a work in progress, which is beneficial to you because I'm not stagnant and I'm motivated to create and bring you incredible programming all the time. So here's a few ways that you can get involved in our We Mentor self-leadership community. You can subscribe for free through wementor.com to the podcast. You can also find it on Apple Podcasts, which used to be iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, Blueberry Directory, iHeartRadio, or TuneIn Radio, which is where you can shout out your request on smart home device through Alexa, Cortana, Amazon Echo, and Google Home. You can also become a sponsor of this program and support what's happening here in these all these meaningful conversations. Or you can get one-on-one mentoring and go at your own pace as you evolve into the leader that you've always wanted to become. You can join a We Mentor Mini Lab, which we offer several times during the year. We're focused on some element of self-leadership and your progress toward becoming more effective. And the last and final way in which you can get involved in We Mentor's self-leadership community is by joining a one-year entrepreneurial leadership and mentoring lab where we dig into the details and help you with the operational along with your leadership skills so you can evolve with your entity and really, really progress in building the life that you've always wanted to build. So please check out wementor.com. You can email me, Nancy, at wementor.com or call me 1-612-804-8920. All right, keep listening and we'll see you next week.